Today, author and activist Paul Kibble is with us to talk about the fourth revised and updated edition of his award-winning best-selling book, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice, which offers a framework for white people to learn how to become aware of the history of racism and to activate themselves. Join us for the conversation today on the Keenest Observer. I'd like to welcome author Paul Kibble. Paul Kibble, social justice educator, activist, and writer, has been an innovative leader in violence prevention for more than 45 years. He is an accomplished trainer and speaker on men's issues, racism, and diversity, challenges of youth, teen dating, and family violence, raising boys to manhood, and the impact of class and power on daily life. Paul Kibble is the author of numerous books and curricula, including Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice, which won the 1996 Gustavus Myers Award for Best Book on Human Rights. Paul Kibble, thanks for being a part of the Keenest Observers on Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. 1996 was the first, or at least you won the Gustavus Myers Award for the book. When did you first publish this book?
It did come out in 1996. That was a period in the mid-90s when a lot of white people were thinking the civil rights movement took care of racism and that we were in a post-racial society. And I felt like the book needed to be out there to remind us and inspire us, those of us who are white, that racism is still an ongoing problem and we need to get busy doing something to address it.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that folks should know that this is voiced to white people, from a white person writing from a particular vantage point in order to inform the dismantling of racism as a social construct and system, which is a lot different than other like books and research that have been published over the some 400 years of this issue. Why did you decide to voice the book in this fashion?
I voiced the book in this fashion because people of color have been writing and producing music and movies and poems and plays about racism for a very long time, and often they are discredited or not given serious consideration by white people because of racism, of the fact that they're people of color and not respected for what they bring. And I realized that this is a book that I wanted to be out there for white people to really speak honestly and personally with them about what we're involved with. But it took me a while to write it, to actually get to the point of writing it, because I thought that I wouldn't do it perfectly. I would make mistakes. I didn't know enough. I didn't have enough experience. People wouldn't like me, wouldn't like the book. And then finally I realized that these are all the excuses that as white people we give for not getting involved with doing racial justice work, for not interrupting racism when we see it around us. And I realized that this is exactly the challenge that we face, is getting over that initial hurdle of wanting it to be perfect, wanting to be good people, wanting to not make waves or mistakes. And that's part of what keeps racism in place. That's our silence is complicity with the status quo.
Yeah, I thought that was an incredible, courageous and vulnerable point in your prologue to say, hey, your own trepidation on writing this book, is a part of the work that is integral and that the work actually being done. I thought that was a beautiful admission, but also a beautiful testament to what one can do to work. So kudos to you over the years for doing that work, for sure.
I think it can feel overwhelming once when we see what's happening in our country and we see what the issues are. But what I realized was that we don't have to do it all. We can't do it all. But each of us has a role to play. And finding our role is what's key, and doing what we can do with the resources that we have.
Right. That's like you said, very key. When we we're going to get into the depths of the book and the actually the history of the book, because like I mentioned, this is the fourth edition of this book, which I think speaks to an interesting dynamic that that speaks to the necessity of the fourth edition of the book from 1996 to 2017. What do you think, and what were you thinking when you revised the book for 2017?
I was, you know, racism is part of the very foundation of our society, and it's pervasive and systematic in our institutions and our cultural institutions and in our daily lives. But it looks a little differently in each period. And I wrote the first edition when Clinton was president. I wrote the second when Bush was president. I wrote the third when Obama was president. And each of those periods, there were particular ways that white people were denying or minimizing the importance of racism. And even recently, polls show that the majority of white respondents think that racism is not a major problem in our society. And the majority also think that, in fact, it's not a problem at all in their community. Hmm. And so today, here we are with an administration which is blatantly racist in its rhetoric and its policies, where young immigrants, DACA youth, are under attack, where there's a Muslim bans being proposed, where police murder in the streets is going unaccounted for, and it's a different historical period. And because of that, I think there's a lot more white people who are saying, wait a second, there is something seriously wrong here, and it's something that I cannot any longer ignore. And so the book this time is much more focused on what does it mean to break the silence in white communities? What does it mean to stand as an ally, to show up with people of color for racial justice? Because we have a period where I think we have the opportunity to really make some major changes in our society, and more white people are wanting to be part of that.
We're going to get onto that on the break. I'm with Paul Kivel, who has a seminal work called Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. We're talking with author Paul Kivel about his book, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, we were about to get into what I'm calling the construct of your book, which is like pretty exhaustive. It's like a textbook or a primer on how the history of racism kind of has been constructed in America and the world, and gives a real hefty kind of like deep dive for white people to kind of consider how they engage in the system and then what they can do to activate themselves, with a history in between. I'd like to play, before we get into the real structure, a piece of yours that gets into some of the like mission-based, you know, ideas that you have. Let's hear.
There's two questions that I use to guide me in thinking about what I am doing and how. First question is one that we often ask ourselves. The question is, what do I stand for? Right? It's a question we check in with ourselves about, you know, am I a person of integrity, of trust, of respect? What are the values that I live by? What kind of moral person am I? But there's another question I found that is equally as important but often overlooked. And the second question is, who do I stand with? And that's a question that really is much harder to ask and much harder to answer.
Why do you start with these two questions as the prompt and premise of the work?
I start with those questions because I think they're essential to who we are as people, as individuals, what our values are, but also what our behavior and actions are. And so, you know, we all, I think, most white people would say they're against racism. They're for equity and equal opportunity for everyone. But the second question, who do you stand with, was a question that was asked by me, was asked of me and other white people by African Americans over time. And they didn't want to know what I stood for. They wanted to know what I was doing. How was I showing up? And because there's racism in our educational system and in our healthcare system and in the criminal legal system. There's racism in the job and housing market. So they want to know is, what are you doing to help us address these inequalities and the devastating impact they have? So I wanted the reader to keep in mind and that question, how are we showing up for racial justice?
And so consequently, you give a kind of a basis in which to make that assessment. You really kind of get into the real deep water that make people have to look at what they believe. You have segments on cultural appropriation, white benefits, retaining benefits, avoiding responsibility, keeping the economic power structure, the culture of power. Over the years, what are some of the reactions of people as they kind of examine themselves through the issues and benefits of racism?
I've certainly met with a lot of resistance at times. Because just like when African Americans came to me and others with stories of racism, my first response was to throw up my hands and say, well, I'm not racist. I'm a good person. I treat everybody with respect. I don't see color, you know, all those things that those of us who are white often do. And so that's a not uncommon response to being confronted with racism by white people. It's partly because we live in very segregated societies. Our housing is segregated, our schools are segregated, our religious institutions, our job places. We don't have a lot of experience with people of color in general, and we're very misinformed. The textbooks we have are woefully inadequate, and every day on the media, video games, cartoons, movies, etc., have messages to say that white people are superior and have done everything powerful and wonderful in the world, and people of color are inferior and dangerous and shouldn't be part of our community. So that's the kind of resistance. At the same time, most white people are aware that racism is around, that it's happening, and want to have some conversation about it. They want to have a chance to try out some, their ideas and beliefs and test out what they're thinking and hear from other people. So as much as I get some resistance, there's a tremendous relief I find among many white people to actually be able to have an honest conversation about what's going on and actually to learn a little bit more about what the reality is rather than what the cultural fantasy is about racial relationships.
To that point, can you talk about how you structure the book and how you were looking to inform and activate folk with the structure?
I think there's three things that are really important for those of us who are white. The first is because we're often misinformed, we have to do some work around learning about our history, getting a more honest understanding of our history and about the current reality in our society. But we also have to do some work in terms of what we've internalized or socialized about racism, about people of color, about white people, about what's going on. So the first sections of the book are a lot about those internalized dynamics, the kind of the work we have about sense of entitlement or cultural appropriation or what kind of benefits we've had from the system of white dominance, and what does that cost us as white people as well. The second part is really about, okay, so how do we speak up and interrupt the silence? How do we talk about race and racism with family members, with our children, with, you know, our students, with our coworkers, with our neighbors? How do we begin to really get involved in that way? And then there's there's a big section on history and looking at how do we get to this place and the institutions in our society. How does the criminal legal system perpetuate racism, and what does it look like in the healthcare system and the educational system? But finally, the core part of the book, and this is woven throughout rather than sequentially, is what does it mean to show up as an ally? And there's a large section with a lot of suggestions and guidelines for what does it mean every day to be aware of racism, to interrupt it, but also just to be organizing with other white people and with people of color to be challenging the institutions in our society and building the kind of communities that we want to live in.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you do a really comprehensive job of constructing a way of developing awareness in a very accessible fashion, and giving checklists and guides and figures to be able to help the reader kind of be able to do some introspection in that process.
And that's really important. I mean, I've been there. I've been through that process with myself, and I've been, you know, leading people through it for a long time. But it's one thing to go through it individually. It's even more powerful to go through it with friends or coworkers or a study group, or to be really grappling with not just our personal growth, but so how does racism look in our community? How does it look in this workplace or this school? So the book also serves as a tool for groups of people coming together to have these conversations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You say the purpose of uprooting racism is about uprooting the system of racism. One may need to look at their individual beliefs and actions to participate fully. What's the difference between the individual and systemic issues of race and racism?
Well, the individual issues are around what we think and how we act in our interpersonal relationships, and that can play out in minor microaggressions or large-scale silencing or marginalization of people of color around us. It can look at like an act of discrimination or a hate crime or, you know, personal action. But the institutional levels are how it gets built into our systems, regardless of our individual behavior. So, for instance, I can be a teacher in a school and teach all my students well, regardless of their differences, and help them on to the next grade level and support them. But if I'm teaching in a school where there's no teachers of color and where the curriculum doesn't reflect the contributions of people of color to our society, and a school in which students of color are disciplined more harshly than white students, and white students are more often encouraged to get into AP classes, then regardless of my individual efforts, I'm teaching in an institution that's perpetuating racism. Mm-hmm. And I have to look at that and take responsibility for getting involved in changing that, because that undermines the very work that I'm trying to do as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. We have an e-comment from Christian in Ashland that says, I think a part of the problem is that racism isn't always as overt as many white people assume. It's not always a pointy hood and a tiki torch walking down the street. When I was in high school, I had a white student approach me, an African-American student, and asked me if I could talk like Chris Tucker. Sure, it wasn't the N-word, but the connotation was still there.
Right. I think that that's very true. Often what gets our attention is that really blatant act, you know, neo-Nazis marching in our streets, or somebody who's a media figure who says something, or things like that. But it's the everyday practices. It's the everyday comments, silencing, marginalization, and the way that that gets built into the policies and practices of our institutions that is really so devastating.
I have a call from Phil in Eureka. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I have a couple of comments. The extensive use of the word racism, which is really an intellectual word in many cases, the average people, if you ask them to define racism, it would be a little bit difficult. And the lack of the word prejudice, in other words, there's a lot of prejudice in our lives where we live and so forth. And I realize that in many cases, people are prejudiced as regards skin color. And I noticed, for example, when you talk about people of color, the word skin is omitted. Or black people or white people, the word skin is omitted. In many cases, the common person is not necessarily walking around saying, I don't like Chinese people or Asian people or African-American people. They're prejudiced for other things. They're prejudiced against other things. So when someone has very dark skin, oftentimes people, even though they don't know the person, don't necessarily want to mingle with people of darker color skin over lighter color skin.
Thanks.
And so it seems to me that it's very important to reintroduce the word skin in the conversation for those people who are essentially prejudiced for the color of the skin more than prejudiced against, in quotes, a race. A given race. I don't walk around defining race. I look at people, I look at who they are and so forth, and I can see that some people, when they see a very dark-colored skinned person, they're prejudiced against the skin color or the features, not the fact that they're from some other race.
Thanks, Phil. Mr. Kivel, what do you think about that? You kind of talk about this in terms of the constructs of race as a human concept versus something that is based in genetics or the most definitely the power structures in terms of the historical construct of race. How do you view that comment from Phil?
Well, I think what you're pointing to is right. I talk about the fact that race is a social and economic construct. We're all the same genetically, pretty much, 99.9%. I don't want to get hung up on the terminology around skin or color or we learn how we are socialized as white people to see and treat people that we perceive as different by skin color and other factors, culture and point of origin, as different, and not just different, but dangerous, as outsiders, as people that we should monitor and caution, and our system is set up to lead us to blame them for the problems that we have. And this goes back to the origins of racism in colonial Virginia in the 17th century, where our ruling elites specifically separated enslaved Africans and indentured whites in ways that gave whites privileges, benefits, and that subjected enslaved Africans to further lifetime slavery. And today we're being encouraged to blame recent immigrants and Muslims and African Americans for the problems that we have in our communities, despite the fact that the tremendous inequalities of wealth that we face mean that the people at the top of the economic pyramid are the ones that are influencing our schools and healthcare system and leading us into wars overseas and moving jobs overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep track of the big picture and not get caught up in the language, and keep looking at the institutions, not just the personal behavior.
Mm. We're talking to Paul Kivel about his book, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. I am interested to know a couple of things about your personal mission statement on this work. And you said on your website that the work is guided by one primary question, and that's how can we live and work together to sustain community, nurture each individual, and create a multicultural society based on love, caring, justice, and interdependence with all living things. I'd like to, you know, talk about that further as we continue, how you came up with that as a mission statement, but then even more importantly, how you construct areas of work: racial justice, gender justice, young people, anti-violence, economic justice, religion, and why this construction. Can you talk to me about how you kind of came up with this kind of construction?
I think we live in a very complicated society, and we're not just we belong to lots of different groups and identities, and we found very early on that if we just talked about race and ignored the economic system, for instance, or gender, that we were leaving out really important, crucial pieces of the total picture and the lived experience of so many of us who we all have a gender, we all have a race, we all have a sexual orientation, we have different levels of ability, that none of us live in these simple categories that we traditionally have talked about these issues in. So in order to really understand what we're up against and how to build a society where everybody is included and no one is left behind, we really have to have a language and an analysis that brings us together and shows us the common ways that we can work together. And part of that work is not just building human communities, but realizing our interdependence with all life, our dependence on the earth, our interdependence with plants and animals around us in the natural environment.
Right.
And so that has to be a crucial piece of this work. And again, racism is right there in the middle, because the communities most impacted by environmental devastation are communities of color. And they're also on the front lines of resisting those attacks.
I'm sorry. Let's continue this across the break. I'm Robert Goodwin. Our guest is Paul Kibble, and we're talking about strategies and constructs that white people can use to uproot systemic racism, just like you heard. First, a short break. Stick with us. We're back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, hosting. My guest is Paul Kibble, and we're talking about his book, Uprooting Racism: How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. I'm sorry, I had to cut you off on the backside of that, Paul, but you were talking about a comprehensive universal construct of looking at the world in an interdependent kind of way, and how that is integral in reframing how we work together. I'm paraphrasing as human beings.
That's fine. I think the point I was really trying to make there at the end was that I think most of us are concerned about the environment and global climate change and the future of life on the planet. And even there, racism is a central piece of that, because communities of color are at the front lines of bearing the brunt of the devastation from climate change, and also at the front lines of resistance to it. And so there again, our natural allies as white people is with people of color, not with the ruling elites that are running our political parties and our corporations and other institutions.
Yeah, I have to admit, to be very honest, in prepping this book and learning about your work as a black man in the world, it was very interestingly challenging, to be very honest, because of the awareness that I've had to, you know, and my community most definitely has had to kind of understand just to survive the issues that became that are kind of primary that you address in your book as something that I was given, you know, to, you know, as survival instincts from and tactics from the time I can remember. What does that say that in 2017, after you doing really seminal work for over, 20 years on this book that we're still having to deal with the information gap?
Well, it says, first of all, that we have a lot more work to do. It says that there are deep levels of denial and minimization and blame that those of us who are white indulge in to try to avoid really facing what we're up against and what we need to do. It also says that, you know, the what I call the ruling class in our society, the top 1% or really even the 0.1%, has concentrated so much wealth and power that they control a lot of the messages that we get, the media, the textbooks, and things like that. And so we have continuing layers and levels of misinformation and blaming and scapegoating that we have to wade through and recognize and talk about, because otherwise young people coming up get woven into the same system and grow up to become adults who perpetuate another generation of racism.
Stuart in Ashland, we have you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. This is an important conversation. I just wanted to get your thoughts. I'm white, and I've spent a fair amount of time in East Africa and in Central American black communities, and find that in foreign black communities, I'm quite comfortable, and yet in American interactions, I am more uncomfortable, although, and I wondered if what we're looking at is sort of an American cultural issue rather than a strict racial or skin color issue. And I can take your answers off the air.
Thank you for your question.
Okay, thank you.
That's a good question. It's never an issue of race, because race is constructed for political and economic purposes. So it is a question or a situation in our society in which we've developed, coming out of Europe, a system of white dominance and the exploitation and marginalization of people of color. And in other societies, it looks very different. Not that they don't have racial or other hierarchies, but we have a particular history that we need to understand, how racism arose, how it was manipulated, how it's used. And it's very illuminating to travel to other countries as a white person, especially to a country or a community that is predominantly people of color, and to see the differences, see the kinds of other ways that people organize and think about things. That's part of our insularity here, is because we're white-dominated and a white majority, is that we're cut off from the contributions, the brilliance and creativity and the wide range of contributions that people of color could be making to our society.
I think you do a really great job in the book of giving a history lesson on colonialism and cultural hierarchy to folks to understand how racism became the structure of the founding of America and the economic structural kind of underpinnings, as well as how that then connected to social systems in a way that I think grounds that particular system in an American construct, but also in a world construct. So folks want to kind of get an understanding on why there's a difference when you go to other countries, or what that experiencing means in America. It's a really great opportunity to get a nice and clear lesson with resources to back it up.
I think the other thing that's important about that is that legacy is still ongoing and unacknowledged and unchanged. We can see it in the way the Electoral College system was set up to give the South dominance in the early colonial days, and the fact that it still skews the results of our elections so that it's not a popular vote. But it's a contrived vote that gave us our current president, who lost the popular election but won the Electoral College. So there's just so many ways that legacy, as long as we don't address it, it still dominates our society.
Mike and Eureka, you're on the air. Mike?
Me?
Okay,
hello?
Try again, Mike. You're on the air now.
Am I? Okay, good. Yeah, I just wanted to comment that for me, as a white person, who grew up in a town that was quite segregated, that I was indoctrinated with racism from day one, basically. And all my life, I've had to kind of be aware of it. You know, as I got older, I realized, man, that's not healthy and it's not right. And I have always realized, I feel like a kind of like an AAA person, you know, or alcoholics, you know, problem is that every day I have to be aware that I have this history of racism. And it makes me kind of nervous about who I am and what I have to offer. When I see someone of color or a black person, I always try to smile, and I think it's an attempt to calm my own sense of discomfort and fear of who I am and how I will react and how the person will see me. I'm very aware of it, and even right now my heart rate is up just talking about it. So I just wanted to kind of point that out, that I think that I'm not that unusual for white people. I think white people are afraid of people of color for whatever reason. For me, it's just this stigma of racism, which I feel is wholly unfair and unreasonable. But it's there. It's deep within my DNA, I guess you might say, because that's how I was raised.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Thanks,
Thank
Mike.
You for your conversation.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think that's one of the important things to realize is that as white people, we pay some of the costs of racism. They're certainly not as devastating as people of color pay, but we are taught to fear people of color, and so we live in fear. We are taught our compassion is closed down. We're taught to be insensitive to the experience of others. We live isolated from people of color, so that we're separate from their contributions to our community, the richness that cross-cultural exchange happens. And it makes us nervous and uncertain and just, we are at some level aware of the misinformation that we have and that we don't have an honest sense of our own family histories, much less the history of the country. There's just lots of costs that we pay as white people, and the costs get diminished the more we step up and get involved and build relationships and really stand as allies in the struggle for racial justice.
Yeah, one of the many checklists that you have in the book, Uprooting Racism, is the costs of racism to white people checklists. I think all of these checklists are very interesting, you know, for some introspection. Some of those some of the items on the list are: I don't know exactly what my European American heritage is, what my great grandparents' names were, or what regions or cities my ancestors were from. I grew up, lived in a neighborhood, or went to school or a camp, which, as far as I knew, was exclusively white. I grew up with people of color who were servants, maids, gardeners, or babysitters in my house. And these are like examples of checklist items that allow white folk and readers at large to kind of ascertain their own state of being and maybe even bias.
Well, and also the costs that we pay, the isolation, the fear, the misinformation, the loss of our cultural heritages as our foreparents assimilated into being white when they came here to this country and accepted, bought into the system of racism in exchange for acting like white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. We gave up our cultures, our religions, our languages, our foods, our traditions, our music. It's a checklist really about the costs. And I think that that's part of the motivation for making a difference and getting involved, is that as we realize the cost as well as the larger social impacts of racism, we can see that there is a lot of work for us to do right where we are in our own communities.
I'm talking with Paul Kivel, author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. In the last couple minutes that we have, how did you come to doing this work, you personally? What was the impetus of you kind of starting down this road?
I came of age in the late 1960s and got involved with the anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam, and also the tail end of the civil rights movement, particularly on the campus that I was at, and began to see how much of what I thought I knew was just completely lies and falsehoods, and how misled I had been about what was going on in the world. And I felt there was I really needed to be involved in making a difference. As I referred to earlier, African Americans at that point were coming to, some of us who were white, angry and outraged at the level of racism. And they were asking that hard question, how are you showing up in this struggle? How are you showing up as an ally? And I think my adult life has been engaged with that challenging question. What can I do? How can I be involved? How can I provide tools for other white people to get involved so that we can actually build the communities based on healing and justice and equity that we all want to live in?
Mm-hmm. In the last 20 seconds or so, do you think there'll be a fifth edition?
Well, I hope not, but I think that what I'm trying to do with the book and on my website, which is just paulkivel.com, is to provide a wide range of tools and resources for white people to get involved, to show up as allies, to break the silence, and to work with people of color to really move our society forward in the ways we want it to be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Paulkivel.com, a very expansive resource set from a person who's been doing the work for a long time. Thank you, Mr. Kivel, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Most definitely.